Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Kia ora everybody, I'm Jordan, host of the Kiwi Birth Tales podcast. It's my hope that you find support and comfort in these stories, and I'm really looking forward to bringing you today's episode. Just a reminder before we get started that these are personal experiences and you should always seek medical advice before making any important decisions. I'm not an advocate for any particular model of birth or birth care, and this is simply a platform to share these empowering Kiwi birth tales with you all.
In today's episode of Kiwi Birth Tales, I speak with Bridget, and Bridget takes us through her two pregnancy and birth stories with her daughters Annie and Charlotte. Bridget's first pregnancy was unexpected and quite early in her relationship, so she talks us through that sort of change and how they dealt with that, through to her decision to try and birth in the hospital and what she wanted her birth to look like. Bridget ended up being induced, which eventually led to an emergency C-section, and she talks us through that experience, which was overall pretty positive, and then into her postpartum recovery, so how she found that journey, and we cover quite a few things in that postpartum period, which is awesome. And then we talk through falling pregnant with Charlotte at 6 months postpartum. So Annie was 6 months old when Bridget fell pregnant with Charlotte, and she takes us through that after a hypothyroidism diagnosis and being told that she probably shouldn't get pregnant anytime soon. And then she talks about the pushback that she got from the OBs and hospital around why she should be having an elective C-section or an induction. So she talks about how she made her informed choices there, and then eventually into her induction and VBAC story. So really awesome episode, two really contrasting birth stories, but I know you're going to get a lot out of it, so I will let Bridget do the talking now. Hi Bridget, thanks so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Oh, thanks Jordan, it's really cool to be here. I'm so pleased to be a part of it.
Awesome. Would you like to tell the listeners a little bit about you and who is in your family?
Yeah, sure. So my name's Bridget, and I was born and partially raised in Invercargill, moved to Auckland, and then have settled in Central Otago home. I live in a rural property just outside of Alexandra with Tom, my partner, and our two little girls, Charlotte and Annie.
Awesome. Very cool. And do you want to talk us through what the journey to pregnancy was like for you guys the first time around?
Yeah, sure. So for us, it was unplanned and completely unexpected, but not an entire shock, if that makes sense. I guess everyone kind of knows what could potentially happen. But for us, I hadn't known Tom for very long. So if I backtrack, I'd pretty much met him in late October, and then decided to move to Alexandra on a whim after having met him for him. I did that in November, like desperate, a month later. And then in February, we found out we were pregnant. So it's one of those things I look back on and I'm like, everyone thought I was nuts. Like, absolutely. If one of my friends had told me they were doing that, I would have been like, you're crazy. But I don't know, in hindsight, it's all obviously worked out really well. So, yeah, unexpected and unplanned, not a shock, but has completely worked out for the best.
Yeah, awesome. Cool. And how did you find out that you were pregnant? Did you take a test or have a missed period or other symptoms? What sort of prompted you to do that?
I was pretty much spurned on by a friend. So I think I might have just been like a couple of days late. I've always had really irregular periods, so it wasn't uncharacteristic for me to be a few days late. But my mate was like, oh, nah, take a test, you know, you could be pregnant. Super excited. And I was like, oh, you know, for a laugh, why not? I'll just entertain you. Okay, let's do it. So I remember I did the test and then like the faintest line appeared and I was like, what? No. And just started like hysterically laughing. And Tom was like yelling, what from the end of the house. And I just like, I couldn't deal. Cause I was just like, this is just unbelievable. Like, I can't believe that I'm actually pregnant. So yeah. I just yelled back like, it's positive. We're pregnant. And he kind of, I guess he was kind of in shock that I was probably laughing the way that I was. And he was like, what? Like, what? We're pregnant? And I'm like, yeah, look. So he was really excited once his initial, I guess, shock of my like crazy hysterical laughter had worn off. And we were like, yeah, this is cool. How awesome is this? So I text Jenna the picture of the positive before I actually told Tom, which is so naughty, because I was like, oh, you know, am I seeing things? Is this meant to be right? Like, is this a thing? And she was like, definitely positive. So Jenna was actually the first person to know, and then Tom found out subsequently. But yeah, that was pretty hard case, I think, because I wasn't expecting it, but at the same time was.
Yeah, for sure. And how were you feeling once you found out? Like, did you have many early symptoms in that pregnancy, and then what did the rest of your first trimester look like?
It's so hard case. Like, I was absolutely fine up until that point, and then it was like, boom, found out I'm pregnant, and then just felt seedy all day. Like, I'd been like heavily drinking, needed salt and vinegar chips just to carry me through the day. Felt like I'd been having massive nights on the booze every night for the first trimester. And then it kind of like it lifted. I guess I'm pretty lucky. I was one of those people that it lifted and I felt really good and I just embraced it and loved being pregnant, loved, you know, having a big belly, and I felt really wholesome and healthy and great. So that continued through the rest of the pregnancy. And I guess I didn't really have any problems or issues or symptoms up until maybe the like mid to end of the third trimester. And I started getting a bit of sciatic pain. But that was completely manageable. And I just rolled with it. I was like, hey, if this is all I'm getting, it's pretty good.
Yeah, cool. And had you decided to go with a midwife for your care?
Yeah, so in Central and Alexandra, I don't know whether or not you would have read in the media over the last few months, but there's been issues with women birthing on the side of the road and kind of not making it to hospitals because we've only got a couple of, is it primary birthing units? I always get it confused. Yeah. I think they're called primary birthing units. So, and there's primary birthing units, obviously, because it's such a wide area in Central Otago and Southland and Westland, or the West Coast. These primary units service quite a lot of women. And the alternative to that is driving to a hospital, which is absolutely fine. So for me, I had made the decision early on in the pregnancy that I wanted to birth in a hospital. And that was pretty much primarily because my dad had passed away in the January, so like the month before we found out we were pregnant, and he'd passed away in Invercargill Hospital. And all I wanted to do was kind of, I guess, just have some sort of wholesomeness and like full circle sort of holistic vibe about going back to a hospital. I knew that if I just kind of left that negativity there, I don't know, it's really odd to explain. I could have just birthed here in Alex, but I wanted something positive from the hospital. Tom and I were both born in Invercargill Hospital, but because Dad had died there, I felt like I needed some good vibes and positivity. So that pretty much led the decision to one midwife. In Alex, there's only one that will go down there. And again, it's just incredible how things end up working out. Like, it's she may or may not have been a midwife that I would have chosen to go with had she not or traveled to Invercargill to birth. Mm. That she just ended up being such an incredible midwife. Just she's really holistic and natural, and just we absolutely adore her. I'm like, she's my midwife, Jan. So we've got a real sense of belonging with her, and she was just fantastic throughout the whole pregnancy. I guess for the first pregnancy, it's always really interesting because you don't have a benchmark as to what something should be like. So we were like, what should we be expecting from Jan? Because she's a little bit elusive, but that's just how she rolls. And it was just, it was a really amazing experience, and I was really lucky to have had her as my midwife.
Cool. And so did you choose to do the standard testing that's offered in New Zealand, and did you end up finding out the sex of your baby?
Yeah, so we just, first pregnancy, I didn't really know what else to do, so I just did it all. We just did all the standard testing and drank the gross sugar juice for the gestational diabetes test and sat there thinking, what? Like, I'm pretty sure I've got diabetes now after having that. But, everything was really standard. And the second part of the question, what was that? My God, I've got
Did you find out the sex?
No, we didn't. Look, I am all for whoever wants to do what. And I think irrespective, it would be really, it's an amazing experience to find out what you're having either way. But we just really wanted to hold on to that surprise. And I guess in life now, the life that we live in, you can find out literally everything about everyone and whatever. We were like, look, this is one thing that no one knows, and let's roll with that.
Yeah, awesome. Cool. And did you do any like antenatal classes or any type of birth education before or in preparation for your birth?
Yeah. So I'd looked at doing like a Plunkett antenatal, because that was pretty much the only one that they offered down here. But I don't know, we had to either travel to Cromwell or Queenstown 2 nights a week or do like, I don't know, one Saturday for 8 weeks. And I was just like, oh, nah, that's not really me. It's making it like a little bit of a burden, which is kind of unfortunate because I missed out on having an antenatal group, so to speak. Yeah. But we opted to do the hatched antenatal.
Nice.
Yeah, I think it's Carmen that does that. So it just worked out really well for us. Like, we sat in bed and watched the videos, and it was nice to kind of engage with one another in that respect and have that information together, and then reflect on it after and rewatch pieces that I may or may not have understood. And it was just really, really awesome. It was a great resource.
Yeah, awesome. Cool. And did you have, off the back of that, or I guess throughout your pregnancy, much of a birth plan or thoughts on how you wanted your birth to go?
I've always been a real sucker for birth stories and just birth in general, and one born every minute, like absolutely obsessed with it. Like, people are like, this is actually frightening, Bridge. You should probably stop watching these things. I just think it's amazing. Now it's just such, it's incredible. I'm lost for words. It's that amazing. I didn't really have a plan, so to speak. I wanted to try and have a vaginal birth. I kind of knew what would happen if there were to be interventions, based on what I'd seen primarily on One Born Every Minute. I was like, cool. So the gist I'm getting in my mind is that if I have an induction, then that's likely to cause this, and then So I kind of knew there could be the domino effect or the cascade of intervention that they do talk about. So with that in mind, I was like, let's aim for A, and if B, C, or D happen, that's just what's going to happen. And that's pretty much how it went.
And just before we jump into that then, did you do anything in preparation for your birth? So antenatal expressing, perineal massage, raspberry leaf tea, you know, like all of those types of things. Were you on board with any of them?
Oh, look, you know, no, I wasn't. Like, I did a little bit of curb walking, and then I was like, I'm done here. I don't know. Like, I should have tried a little bit more, but I just kind of felt like I'll wait and see what will happen, and the baby will come when the baby will come. And that was like a mantra that Jan pretty much like drilled into me, like the baby will come when the baby wants to come. And I was like, yeah, but when is the baby going to come? Because it's like, we're like hitting 40 weeks now and I'm getting tired. Yeah. So So I just did the curb walking and that was pretty much it. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. Cool. And did your labor end up starting spontaneously? Do you want to take us through, if it did, how far along you were and a little bit of what happened from there? So into your labor and birth story.
Cool. Yeah. So I hit 38 weeks and I was like, yeah, like my baby was definitely going to come on the 20th of October. Like that's when I was due and the baby was going to come. And then when the baby didn't come on the 20th of October, I was like, hang on a second, what's this? Hadn't really prepared for much more beyond that point. So we did a few stretch and sweeps and then when nothing happened there after, 38, 39 weeks, 40 weeks. And then I started to feel like I wasn't sleeping that great and I started thinking too much about that. And then I started thinking, I should get an induction and let's get this over and done with, which is such a bad way to think. I can now on reflection think that. But I just thought, if the baby gets out, then, we can all kind of move on and I'll be out of this limbo stage. So at around 40 weeks, I started to talk to Jan about an induction. And she was like, look, the baby will come when the baby will come. And I'm like, yeah. But I didn't know it was a she at the time, it's not coming. And I want it to come. And she said, well, look, it's completely up to you what you want to do. We can check you every day and we can do scans and da-da-da, you're fit, you're healthy, this baby's really happy, it will come. And I guess like everyone has a limit to their comfort and or limitations to their comfort levels. And I had got to a point nearing 41, I was actually 41 and 5, where I was like, hang on a sec, like I'm just not feeling super comfortable about this. I'd read up probably a little bit too much about placentas breaking down and then babies being stillborn. And I guess in my mind, I was like, I've hit my limit now for comfort with it. I feel like being told like 38 weeks, this is, this is your due date. This is when your baby should be coming. Now I'm 41 and 5. I'm not happy. Like I think that we really need to move on this and we're up there at the upper limit of my comfort. So I was lucky when I had that conversation with Jan. The following day was, the induction day at Invercargill Hospital. I didn't even know that was a thing. So I went down there. So it was 41 and 4, and then I went down there 41 and 5 and got induced in the morning. I didn't get induced straight away. So got in there, did the usual hospital rigmarole, the waiting around for a bed, and then had an obstetrician come and chat to me and we had a discussion about doing the balloon catheter. So that was inserted and I was instructed just walk, get out of the bed and walk. And so that's pretty much what I did. I just walked and I walked and I walked, and then might have been the next day, like I was literally in there all day, and then the following morning it had fallen out. So I was like, winning, the baby is coming, the baby is definitely coming now. And so they checked me and I was only 3 centimeters, so I was kind of like, oh, she's not good, it's not coming. And then throughout, I guess a few, maybe not throughout the day, but a few hours had passed and nothing more had kind of happened. I was at a bit of a stalemate, I guess. Then the conversation was started about Cinto and I was like, oh, okay, cool. So, the whole cascade of interventions started kind of building in my mind. I was like, okay, now this is completely being taken out of my hands. And I was so ill prepared for an induction. I hadn't looked into, I hadn't looked into it at all. So I went in blind, which may have been a good thing. But I feel as though it was just cranked right up. It probably wasn't, but I was just like, this is the most intense experience and feeling I've ever had in my life. I had this like, it was really funny. I had this like birthing track, and this is how like loopy I guess I am. I wanted like kind of like a mixture of like upbeat, like rap music and pop music, thinking that that would distract me. And I was sucking on the gas at one point, and I just felt like I was Alice in Wonderland at some sort of like crazy gig, falling down a rabbit hole. And I was like, get the music off, get it off. I felt like I was completely out of it. And then once the music went, I was like, the gas has got to go. This is no good for me. I need it gone. So the gas went, and I was just like, hey, I'm going to try and do this without anything. Then it got to a point where some of the nurses came in, and or the midwives, and they were like, oh, you know, heart rate, not kind of happy here with how the baby's looking. And I was like, oh, hang on a second, like what? Like this cascade, it's actually happening. So when an obstetrician came in and looked at the fetal monitor and pretty much said, we need to do an emergency C-section, I was not at all shocked. I was like, okay, cool. Thinking in my mind, right, we're going to be whipped off to, you know, an operating room straight away. And then it was so hard case. Like, baby's heart rate was like in D-cell or whatever they say. And so I was like, cool. And then they were like, here's a form. We just need you to sign all these things. And I'm like, what? Like, is this an emergency or are we good? Like, so I signed my form and then went into the operating theater. And it was all really nice. Like, the surgeon was like, any music, anything you want to listen to? And I was like, no, just whatever you want. Like, you're in control here. I'm happy just to cruise and you do your job and listen to what you want. And I'll just be the patient and be here. And like, yeah, it was really interesting, that experience. So I obviously hadn't had an epi at that point. So I needed to have a spinal block, which was fine. And they were all really, the communication was amazing with me. So everything was spoken through. They told me everything that was happening. We had a student midwife in the room at the time. I forgot to mention Jan wasn't there at this point. So they had given her notice that I wasn't progressing. And so she was like, cool, I'll make my way down. It's a 2.5 hour drive. So by the time they had, you know, told her that, I was being wheeled into an operating room. So fortunately we had the student midwife who was taking photos, and it was all really, really cool. So we've got, look, I'm skipping all over the place. So Annie was born, little girl, yay. So they lifted her up and they were like, it's a girl. And I was like, this is amazing. How cool is this? Regardless of what I had, I guess, expected or planned or hadn't planned for, I was just like, this is really cool. My little baby's here and it's a girl and she's okay and we're all healthy and happy. And we had cool photos and Tom held her. And then we got wheeled into recovery. And then Jan turned up, and it was one of the most, like, it was such an interesting experience, because in hindsight, like, I look back and I'm like, man, I should have done skin to skin. I should have done all the stuff. And Jan actually, when I was in recovery, was like, right, we'll put the baby on chest. So she initiated that skin to skin and, you know, got me doing what I thought everyone else would have been doing. But yeah, it was interesting, because it was kind of like, I hadn't thought about any of that kind of stuff at the time. I was just like, the baby's been born. She's been, you know, put on the wee checking thing. She had like a 9 and a 10 for her APGAR scores, and she was fine, wrapped up in a little bundle, and Tom was holding her, and I was just there, and, you know, and I was watching everything, and everything was fine. But we didn't have that, you know, skin to skin and the first feed straight away and all of that jazz. Wasn't until I was in recovery and Jan came along and was like, cool, now we'll do the skin to skin and let's get this stuff going and let's get her feeding and latching on, and that happened. So that whole experience was, I don't know, it was really interesting, and it just happened. Like, I guess it just happened before my eyes and I just rolled with it. And then, like, I just had a baby and the baby was, there and wrapped up, and I didn't think about the skin to skin and any of that sort of post-birth stuff that I wanted.
It's funny you say that, actually, because, like, I felt really prepared if I was to have a C-section, and I felt like I'd heard a lot of these stories of, you know, the things that you can do even if you have a C-section. And then once I had Jai, I didn't think to be like, put like, I want him on my skin straight away, I want to try and feed him there. Like, I was very similar to you. I was just happy that he was there and healthy and safe, and Joe was holding him and he was wrapped up. And then it wasn't until recovery where I had skin to skin with him then, so we had a really similar journey.
Yeah, it's interesting. And then, you know, like, I see these amazing stories now where people have these, I don't know, they can like pull their babies out themselves, yeah, and the baby, yeah, and I'm like, what? Like, that's incredible. Mm. That's amazing. But I guess like that's, I mean, hindsight's like 2020, and I can look back and be like, man, like next time this is what I'd do. And I totally would. Like, I'd be way more demanding than I was. Mm. But at the time, I think with your first baby, you're just like, look, I just don't want to make waves, and it, like, the baby's here, and this is just, this is how it goes, and this is what it is, and everyone's happy, and yeah. And then on reflection, you're like, oh, hang on, that could have been done a little bit differently, and if that hadn't have happened, then that wouldn't have happened, and then that could have happened. So, but, you know, who cares? It's all good at the end of the day. She was healthy and happy, and was not coming. They did say that to me. They were like, that baby was definitely not keen on coming. She was tucked all the way up. She was really high. There was no way that you were going to be having that baby anytime soon. And I was like, it's so fascinating. I'm like, how do you know that? Like, that's incredible. But we just, you know, when we got wheeled out of recovery and we were in our wee room, like, oh, it was the most incredible feeling. Like, I just felt like I had just been hit with the biggest amount of endorphins. Like, I just felt like I was on cloud 100, and I had this little bubble of Tom and a little baby, and like, we just, nothing was going to burst it, and we just felt so good, and life was amazing. So, you know, I couldn't move, and I had a catheter, and, you know, it wasn't the most like painless experience. But I had this amazing baby, and my partner was there, and I was like, this is just heaven. I felt incredible, and it was such an amazing feeling. It was just so special. Yeah, loved it.
Yeah, awesome, cool. And how long did you spend in the hospital then after your C-section?
I think I was there for, so she was born around, what time was she born? 9 o'clock at night. So we had that night, the next day, another night, and then we left the next morning. So, and the Cargill Hospital were great. Like, I just, it was one of the best things about that hospital is dads can stay. Like, they wheel out a little bed and they're like, you stay here. And like in Dunedin, dads often can't stay, or there's a shared room and there's chairs that they can sleep on. And I was just like, no, if I cannot do that, like, why wouldn't we go to Invercargill where, you know, you have a welcome mat rolled out, Tom, let's go there. So, yeah, the whole experience at Invercargill Hospital was amazing. I couldn't talk any highly of it. So then, but, you know, it's like a hospital at the same time. You're like, okay, can we leave yet? Like, is it time to go? And, you know, on a plane, everyone stands up and the doors are open, but you can't move. That's what a hospital's like. We were like, yeah, okay, well, we've been discharged, so what are we waiting for? And they're like, oh, we've got to do the rounds and the forms need to be signed. And I'm like, oh, let's just go. So it wasn't until I think like 1 o'clock in the afternoon that we ended up, you know, being given the exit. So we left there, and then before we made our journey back home with our wee baby, we decided to visit my grandparents so that they could, you know, have the newborn feels. So we just had a wee lunch with them, and they met our little baby Annie. And then we drove up to our, I guess what's the equivalent of birth care in Auckland, which is called Charlotte Jean down here. Sorry, we got another 2 nights in Charlotte Jean, where it's just the most incredible place. Midwives, and you're just like at home, and you know they've got all your food for you, and they help you with your feeding, and just, it's just a great supportive place to be.
Yeah. And how were you managing with like the pain from your surgery? Were you taking just like the recommended painkillers all the time, or did you not find it too bad? How were you feeling?
I was fine. Like, I felt really good, and like, I'm probably a bad billboard for like C-sections, because I was like, this is wicked. Like, I feel great. Like, it's, you know, I mean, I probably approached it a little bit differently. Like, they're all like, you know, you shouldn't walk too much and you shouldn't do this. And I'm like, puh, every other surgery, they're like, get out there and move about, get the blood flow going. So I was kind of, you know, I was within reason, I was moving as I could, and just, I literally just had paracetamol. And just, I don't know, I felt really good after it. I didn't have any issues. My scar was great. The bandaging, everything was fine. Like, I felt really supported in my tummy. I kept really fit throughout my pregnancy, though. That's something I didn't mention. I was really, really fit. Like, I was going to the gym a couple of times a week right up until she was born. So, and I think that definitely contributed to it hugely. So,
Yeah, awesome. Cool. And how did you find it once you got home and you've got your new little baby there, and yeah, just everything sort of changed, and how did you find that experience in that first, you know, week or two once you get home?
So wild. Like, once we got home, we were like, what do we do now? We just put her in a capsule, and we just put her on the table, and we were like, cool, like, now we've got a baby and she's here in our house and that's ours, and like, what do we do now? And it was kind of like, well, let's wait for, you know, the next feed, or let's wait until we need to change her nappy. And then that starts kind of, I guess, what you do. We were just like, we have a baby. So we introduced her to the dogs. We did the rounds of the dogs and they sniffed at her. And then I guess we just kind of chilled. We just enjoyed being with her and with each other. And we started to get a few visitors, and it was absolutely fine. I guess I'm really lucky, and I say this kind of, I guess, strangely, but I'm lucky that I had her in a place where I didn't have a lot of family and friends. So we weren't bombarded by a whole lot of people. Like, obviously, Tom's friends, being mostly guys, they weren't rushing to the door to meet the baby. and, you know, their wives, their partners, whilst they were obviously fairly respectful that they hadn't known me for that long.
Yeah, sure.
That, you know, it was just really interesting in family. Like, I didn't have my family down here. I had my auntie and uncle, actually, they lived next door. So they popped around. And I forgot to mention, actually, I decided I wanted a puppy, a boxer, because they changed the laws on the docking of tails, and I'd had one before, and I was like, I have to have one without a tail, which I know people think is super cruel, but I just, that's each their own. So I wanted one without a tail before it became illegal. So I was like, well, the baby will turn up at 38 weeks. So I'll have 2 weeks with the baby, and then the pup will turn up and we'll be away laughing. Obviously, it didn't work out like that. So the day that I bought Annie home was the same day that Rosie came home. So I got home to a, how old is it, 8-week-old puppy, and with a newborn baby, which everyone was like, you're absolutely nuts. And I'm like, I know, like, I moved down here after a month of knowing the guy. Like, of course I'm nuts. I've got a dog at the same time I've got a baby. Like, what have you thought any different? But it was the best. Like, the pup would, you know, need to go out, and Annie would cry, and I was just like, I've got this. Like, I've got you both. We're all good. So I missed that. That's another crucial part of my nutty story, I guess. But we were cool. Like, we enjoyed just being together, having each other, and having frozen meals that people had prepared for us, you know, being a little community, a smaller community to what I'm used to in Auckland. Like, you know, people that Tom knew through work would turn up with a casserole dish or like a lasagna, whatever. Like, I was like, this is wicked. Like, how cool is this? This would never happen in Auckland. I don't even know you when you're giving me a lasagna. So we loved him.
Awesome. Very cool. And how did you find breastfeeding? Was it your intention to try and breastfeed her, and how did you find that journey?
I didn't think too much about it. I was like, breast is best, whatever, so is fed. And I was like, look, I'll give it a whirl, I'll try it. And she latched on fine, and we fed really well, and it was amazing. I didn't get any mastitis. I had absolutely no issues. And then I ended up being asked to be a bridesmaid for one of my best friend's wedding, and that was in Auckland. And I was like, oh, like, you know, Oh, that was a crucial issue, sorry. She fed well, she latched well, but I couldn't pump. Couldn't pump for the life of me. I got a Hakka pump, didn't do it. I had a, like, medella or whatever they're called, like a grunty double thing that pump, and I got like a mill. I couldn't do anything to get milk. So when I knew this wedding was coming up, I got quite panicky. I was like, I need to feed Annie. She has to obviously get something. And my mum was like, just give her a bottle. She'll be fine. And I knew being fed is best, but I was like, oh no, she's exclusively breastfed. I need to keep going with it. And I just went on this like wacky sort of like ride with being exclusively breastfed and fed, and I must keep her like that. And then I probably got like, I don't know, 2 weeks before the wedding was like, yeah, that's not going to work because she needs something and I can't find any donor milk and I need to feed her. So I just started introducing formula, and best thing I did, honestly, it was amazing. So it relieved me of the stress of having to pump and not being able to.
Yeah.
And it gave, I guess, like Tom an opportunity to bond with her as well. Yeah. It's such a special bonding moment. And, you know, sometimes the dads, they just sit there and they're like, I can't do anything. Like, I can change the baby and that's pretty much it, but she just wants you. So from that regard, like, it was really nice to share the load and give him the opportunity to have that bonding time and have, you know, it's such a special time doing that. And that's what formula really provided us with as well as the freedom of being able to go to a wedding.
Yeah. Yeah. I found a similar thing with Jai. He was mixed fed from birth, well, literally from birth. And I thought it was such a nice bonding thing for him and Joe, my partner. I just loved watching Joe feed him with a bottle. So I can definitely relate to that. And how did you find your mental health in terms of your recovery from birth and just like the whole experience of becoming a mum, and it's such a life change? Did you notice any of the baby blues, or how were you feeling sort of mentally?
I think like there was I felt like we had this high in the hospital, and I was just like, this bubble was incredible.
Yeah.
And then I think we got home and maybe like a week or two later, I just had like a bit of a lull and everything felt like it was a little bit too much. I don't know. I just got really overwhelmed really, really quickly. But that was pretty much the extent of it. Like, you know, my mum was really good, and Tom's family were amazing. His mum was great, and his sister, who had twin girls earlier or the year before, they were kind of like, you know, this is, you know, you're fine, this is normal, like, you've got us all here, we're all here to help, and just shout out, like, you've got the village. And the village was really strong. I had a great village, and people just helped. But I guess I felt like a little bit of a lull. Like there was the high of coming home and having the baby, and then it was, and now what do I do now, and how am I supposed to feel? And yeah, you kind of get into the rhythm of having everything together again, and, you know, not relying on the frozen meals and being able to, you know, dip your toe into making something, like, I don't know, whatever in the kitchen that's super easy, and you're like, I've got it together, I know what I'm doing, there's a lot of washing on, I've hung it out today. And you slowly get there with, you know, things become easier and it becomes more of a routine. But I definitely think there's that period of, it's really overwhelming, I've still got all this stuff to do, unless I have the village here to help me and I'm telling them what I need. Because, you know, like, I was like, oh no, just sit down, like, I'll get you a tea. People were like, no, you just had a baby, like, what can I do for you? And I'm like, I don't want you like folding my undies. And then that passed like 2 days and I'm like, yeah, daddy undies are there, like, they need to go there, like, do this, do that. So I definitely got more confident as I realized I definitely wasn't feeling the greatest and I needed help and I couldn't do everything.
Yeah. Awesome. Cool. And what about your relationship with your partner? This is, something that I always get asked to ask on the podcast, is how did you find that shift in your relationship, obviously going from just being the two of you and, you know, you can just do things how you want to and everything is relatively carefree for the most part. And then you've got this baby who just needs your attention 24/7 and there definitely is a shift, or I found that there was a shift in the way that your relationship is for that period of time. And yeah, how did you find that experience with your partner?
It was really interesting. Maybe I feel because Tom and I hadn't actually known each other for that long, that I couldn't honestly say there was a huge shift. Mm-hmm. Like what our norm was before Annie, like, you know, like I'd met him, we'd only known each other for a short amount of time, and then I was pregnant, and we just, like, pregnant was our norm. So like, yeah, we kind of didn't like go out and like do fun crazy stuff like in the early stages of a relationship. Like we never really had that.
Yeah.
Especially because just after I'd met him, my dad had died, and then we found out we were pregnant. So it was kind of like, it was wild. It was such a roller coaster for us. So when we had Annie, it was kind of like, this is our family. And I don't know, we had a little unit, and that was our norm. Like it's really interesting thinking about that, because I'm like, in the 3 years that I've known Tom, I've pretty much been pregnant the entire time. And it's just like, I'm like, do you even know me? He just thinks I'm crazy. Pregnancy crazy. Our relationship changed because that was kind of all we really knew, being pregnant or having had a baby.
Yeah, cool. Awesome. And did you want to take us through when you felt comfortable to be intimate with your partner again? So what was the journey like back into intimacy for you guys?
Oh, look, I mean, I guess that's what happens with a C-section dictated a lot of that. So, like, I mean, I don't think I went to Jan or my GP and said, you know, when can we go again? Jan probably even said, like, you're good to go. She would have definitely said that. I don't know. I guess we just kind of warmed back into it, like feelings, levels of comfort and how I felt and whether or not I was sore. I honestly can't remember how long it would have been, but whatever the recommended sort of time frame would have been, plus a day, I would imagine. But it's really interesting, like pregnancy for me, like I've heard on one of your previous podcasts with someone, I can't remember who it was, but I just actually adored it. And her partner, she had said to you that she had a really low sex drive during pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I've had a conversation with one of my friends about, because she's the absolute opposite. She's got a crazy high sex drive. But for me, I don't. Like, I don't want to be touched. Like, it sounds so bizarre, but I just do not have a high sex drive. And it's really hard because, you know, you've obviously got to navigate a relationship where you're everyone's happy. So there's obviously, you know, times where you have to make compromises with everything. And that's definitely one thing that we have to in our relationship, because I just don't have that drive. But then everyone has a need that needs to be fulfilled and met. Yeah. So. Yeah. I find that really interesting, because there is often, I feel, this idea that, you know, you have a high sex drive when you're pregnant, but not everyone is like that. Like, I'm certainly pregnant. It's absolute opposite. Like, just I'm like, you've already touched me, we're good, do not touch me.
You touched me once and this is what happened, so no more enough. Touching me for 9 months. Cool, awesome. And you obviously found the time to be intimate again at some stage, because I know that you fell pregnant with your next baby not too long after your birth. So do you want to talk us through finding out that you were pregnant?
Definitely. So I don't even think, and this sounds so stupid to say this, but I'll blame someone else. No one really said, hey, you shouldn't have a baby this long after you have a C-section. Someone would have said that. I'll go back. I had been at a point, maybe like when Annie was 5 months old, been getting really achy shoulders, and I didn't feel good. And I went to the doctor, and she was like, you know, are you pregnant? And I'm like, no, definitely not. She's like, okay, well, we'll do some bloods and da-da-da-da. So anyway, my blood test came back, and it came back with 4 hypothyroidism. So that's when your thyroid isn't working, and that's the better of the two to have. So hyper is when, I don't know, it works over time. And hypo is when it doesn't work over time. So that's all to do with your induction. I'm not a doctor. I don't know. I won't start telling people what it's about. Google that. But the gist of it is, as soon as I was diagnosed, the doctor said, do not get pregnant. You need to regulate your thyroid with medication. You'll be taking medication every day. So until you get to a point where we've got consistent blood readings or thyroid readings through your blood, you shouldn't get pregnant. Literally the next day, pregnant. So I honestly, it was literally the next day. So I phoned up and I'm like, you know, hey, Penny, she's my doctor. I'm like, you know how you said not to get pregnant? She's like, yeah. I'm like, yeah, well, I am. She's like, okay. So it was interesting. She had a pretty frank discussion with me around the research around early pregnancy and people with hypothyroidism and the effects of an unregulated thyroid on a baby. And a lot of the research wasn't actually that favorable in regard to, you know, I say unfavorable, but the research suggested that babies that were in utero with a mother that had an unregulated thyroid were more likely to have a lower IQ or, you know, something like that. And I was just like, okay, is that it? She's like, well, you know, you might want to think about what you want to do. And she said that in a medical way, like not in a, you should be doing this kind of a way. And I just sat back and I said to Tom, oh, you know, we might, sounds really bad, we might have a slow baby anyway, like might not make a difference. And we were kind of like, well, you know, like what, you know, like, so we'll carry on, let's keep going. It doesn't matter, who cares, like anything can happen. So from that point, I just had to have blood tests every 2 months just to check that the thyroid levels were regulated. I had medication daily. So we found out we were pregnant through all of the thyroid bizzo and, not meant to being pregnant after having had a C-section only, 6 months before. So the recommendation, what is the recommendation? It's like, don't get pregnant until 12 to 18 months
or something. Everyone will tell you something different.
Yeah. So Tom looked at me 6 months later and I was like, yeah, we're pregnant. So yeah, the second baby pregnancy was really interesting. So after having had the experience that I'd had with Annie, I obviously was like, I need to research this in a different way, not just watching One Born Every Minute or as amazing as podcasts are, just listening to podcasts. Like, I actually need to actively find information out for myself and make my own informed decisions about what's going on. And that's what I did. So I pretty much spent the next 9 months learning about cascade of intervention and different choices and different options and various ways to have a baby and medication, you know, all sorts of stuff. So I went through the same rigmarole of feeling like, you know, absolute ass through my first trimester, and it was the same pregnancy with Annie. It was exactly the same. And so I looked at all of my options and I had found actually a really incredible support group, VBAC Aotearoa. And it was incredible. It was just filled with stories of positive VBACs and unsuccessful VBACs, which were still positive births for all of the beautiful women involved. But for me, I think it just opened my eyes a little bit more to how, I guess, you go down this journey and how things can change and how, I guess, if you don't have someone that's advocating for you and if you don't have, I guess, the really strong sort of value of what you want, you can be highlighted as a difficult person, which I was. but at the end of it, you're like, I've fought for what I've wanted, and if it does work, yippee, and if it doesn't, I tried. And I think that is the best way to go into it. So going through the journey of pregnancy with Charlotte was interesting. I definitely rocked a few boats. So I was on the radar of the Invercargill Hospital or the Southern District Health Board. And I had a scheduled appointment with an obstetrician quite early. And that was assessing the risks of the fact, you know, that I had become pregnant in their mind, frankly, too soon. And it was a high risk pregnancy, high risk of rupture. You know, all of the realistic information they put it to me. So I had a meeting with an OB early on, and it was great. It was pros and cons of both a C-section and a VBAC. And I went into it thinking, oh, you know, either way, whatever. Whatever. Sounds so flippant. I just, you know, whatever will be, will be. And then I started to get on this, like, ride of gaining the information. And I thought, you know, like, if I want to have subsequent pregnancies, this is really where my stalemate is. If I have another C-section, then I'm at a greater risk of rupture. So I'm not going to have a natural birth or a VBAC after that. I'm just going to have another incision made, and it's going to be another C-section. And then, I mean, they're not going to not deliver your baby if you keep getting pregnant. But obviously there's a high risk. You're thinning out your uterus, and there's many complications for baby and mum. So in addition to that, I was like, let's count on our fingers and toes. Annie will be 15 months old when the baby is born. And how can I tell a 15-month-old that I can't pick her up? Yeah. And I'm choosing to do that. Like, if it's an emergency, it's an emergency. They have to do what they do. But I'm like, if I'm choosing to do that and I'm, you know, I can't pick my baby up, she just can't be picked up. So that was when I was kind of like, right, so I need to become equipped with all the information that I need for having a VBAC. And that's where that VBAC Aotearoa page was amazing, reading all those stories. So I put a bit of a plan together around just rolling with it, not being induced, not planning anything. In Jan's words, the baby will come when the baby will come. And that was all very well until I started getting phone calls. So I think, when did the first one come? The first one might have been when I was 20 weeks with Charlotte. And it was like, oh, you know, Lily here from Invercargill Hospital, just, you know, touching base with you. And, you know, we're wanting to discuss an elective C-section with you and dates that might work. And I'm like, what? Like, hang on. Yeah. What? Like, what is this? And I was like, got all cagey about it and kind of said, oh, you know, sometime in 40 weeks, let's go with that. Brushed her off. And then after that conversation, I phoned Jan and I'm like, Jan, what's going on? Like, I feel like they're, you know, like, this is where they're directing me and I don't want to go there. And she's like, you don't have to go there, just leave with me. So that was fine until I got another phone call and they were like, yeah, so we're going to have to move that date and we need to bring forward a week to 39 weeks. Because the obstetrician wasn't happy and they wanted to have it on this date. And I'm like, whoa, I don't want it then. Like, can we do something else? Like, I don't know. Like, again, I'd equipped myself and I knew I could be like, absolutely not, no thanks. But for some reason, I felt like it was a negotiation and I started negotiating. And I'm like, so the conversation got a little bit, I guess not heated, but I just felt a little bit caged and I knew that it wasn't what I wanted, and I just kind of like maybe flipped out a little bit and was like, talk to my midwife, I can't cope, because it was only like 5 or 6 weeks after that initial conversation. So then Jan took a hold of it, love her, and phoned them and was like, you know, like, you're causing her a lot of stress, this is the plan, this is what we're going with, it would be ideal if you just left her alone and we just carried on our trajectory and, you know, la la la. And, you know, she did what she needed to do. I didn't get another phone call, but I did get a letter. Oh, it was so good. I've still got it somewhere too. And it was pretty much about how I was ill-equipped with knowledge and didn't understand the severity of my situation, and how, you know, I was ill-informed and needed to, yeah, understand the significance of what the dangers were with a VBAC and la la la. And I guess at the end of the day, like, it's ass covering. I don't know if I should say that. It probably isn't a nice thing to say, but it's all based, I mean, it's all relative. Like, yes, there is a higher risk, therefore we're trying to reduce that risk by having an elective and freeing up a hospital bed so you're not an emergency C-section, because that operating theatre needs to be left for someone who is an emergency. So if we can control it, we will. So I completely understood that that was what was happening in the background. So in order to kind of regain control of the situation, we agreed instead of an elective C-section happening, we would be having an induction. And with the induction, because I'd done my research and I'd read, you know, all of the Facebook pages, I was like, I can dictate what sort of induction I want. And I want a soft induction. I want to do the balloon catheter again and have my waters broken. And then let's just wait and see. So that was scheduled for 40 and 5. They agreed to let me go 40 and 5, which was awesome. And I was obviously praying in the background that, you know, I'd do my curb walking again and, you know, that would kick off labor, which it didn't. There were a couple of nights where I was like, I'm definitely in labor. This is definitely it. And then nothing would happen. And I'm like, I'm actually going nuts. Like nothing happened. There was absolutely nothing going on. But then I think the day before we went down to Invercargill, like the Braxton Hicks were stronger. And I was like, yeah, it's all going. Like, this is all happening. It's positive. So by the time we got down there, they didn't even do the balloon catheter. I was dilated. I can't remember how much, but they just broke my waters. So the deal with that, though, was, because there's a deal with everything, I had 2 hours from that point. I was like, 2 hours? Like, who comes up with this? So I had 2 hours from the point of my waters being broken to progress, and if I didn't progress, then there would be another conversation. And so I was like, okay, part of my negotiation was I didn't want one of those IV lines in. I was like, cool, yeah, I'm good with that. I can do the 2 hours, but I don't want an IV line in. And it was so hard case. The OB was like, no, you get the IV. And I'm like, oh, it was like, thanks. Like, I was trying to like advocate for myself because Jan wasn't there at that point either because I was being induced. So, I ended up texting her and being like, what do I do? I've got 2 hours. She was like, walk. And if that doesn't work, get Tom on your nipples. And so we walked and we walked and then we sat back down in the room and I was like, it's time, Tom. And so, like, you know, I took my top off and he stood there so awkwardly. We started laughing. Like, it was just the most awkward situation where he was just kind of like, you know, like in that movie, Meet the Fockers, is it? And he's like milking the cat. Like, it was pretty much like that. Tom was like making weird eye contact. And then I was like, okay, you can stop. So I took over myself and started doing it. And it was the most incredible feeling. Literally after about 30 seconds of nipple stimulation, I was like, oh my God, it started. My labor has started. And 5 minutes later, the OB came in and I was like, you can leave. The labor has started. We are all good. And he was like, okay, that's cool. So he left and I text Jan and I was like, look, we're having contractions. This is, you know, it's all go, we're happening. So she was like, cool, I'm on my way. So from that point, I had relatively consistent contractions and it was the coolest feeling. I was, you know, I was in labor. I haven't been in labor before, you know, properly. I say in inverted commas because it was through a drip and that was like it was not the most ideal situation for me. So I was like, this is amazing. I am in labor, and if anything, I've had this sensation and my body has given it to me. So I felt really good about that. And then we got moved into the delivery suite and I just felt really awful. I had a plan. I was like, yeah, I'll just do the gas again. And you know, I don't want any pain relief, just gas and we'll be good. And I had more soothing music on. I'd learnt from the previous time, no rap. I was like, I just need calmness and serenity in my room. And I didn't feel like I was at a rave and having a bad trip this time, but the gas certainly didn't do it. I was just thinking, like, I had a go on the gas and I was just like, oh, nah, like, it's making me feel way too spaced out. And I just didn't do it for me. So I was like, oh, we need the bath. Let's get the bath going. I'll try and go down the avenue. So at this point, the bath hadn't been turned on and I started vomiting and I felt really, really, really awful. And then Jan walked in the room and normally Jen wears black clothes and is like a bit of a hippie. She's got the long gray hair and like lots of bangles. And I looked up and I thought I was hallucinating because she was in like a floral dress. And I was just like, what's happening here? Who are you? And it was like the one day of her entire life she decided to wear color because her granddaughter had told her she needed to wear color. And I was just, I just couldn't deal with what was happening. I'm like, who is this? Is this Jan? So it was one of the most amazing experiences, though, where, I don't know if you've ever felt this, where someone will enter a room and all of a sudden they have literal control of it. So she walked into the room and was like, right. It was like it was her room. She said, Tom, this is your job. You do this. Put your hand here. And this is what you need to be saying to her. And rub her and put your hand here at this point. And we don't need you and you and you out. I was just like, oh my God, this is so awkward. I can't believe she just did that. How rude. But it was the best thing. She just took control of the room. She had it completely together. Everyone was given, I guess, their role, and she was sorted. I was still like, why isn't the bath going? I can't hear water, and I need water in the bath. While everyone's talking and being given their roles, I'm waiting for the bath because it's going to make me feel a million times better. So, you know, I was spewing and requesting the water again and again, and then all of a sudden, like everyone had been in the hall talking and I was like, oh my God, what's going on? So the monitor, the fetal heart monitor, the same thing started to happen. And purely by chance, I think this time I had an obstetrician who may have been a little bit older and may had seen a few more things before. And while a few of the midwives were saying, you know, this isn't good, like, you know, we need to start thinking about what we might need to do here. Jan the midwife and the obstetrician were like, no, it's fine. This is fine. It's all consistent with a contraction happening and the heart rate going down. This is fine. This is all normal. We don't need to be panicking about this. So that was all happening in the background while I was requesting the water and being really disheartened that I wasn't in the bath. So by the time I got in the bath, I wanted the hell out. I just did not like the bath. It was the worst place that I could be. I just had this idea that it would just be the most serene environment. And I was like floating in the water and it was all calm and like pictures and videos and one born every minute. Like I just had this vision of it being so peaceful and I just wanted out. I felt really bad at the time. Like what a waste of water. It's funny how you think about these things. Yeah. But I was like, I've just wasted like, I don't know, 100 liters of water. How awful am I? So I got out. I just got out. I just could not deal with being in there. I probably was in there for less than 30 seconds. And in hindsight, that was transition. But I didn't realize it at the time. Yeah. But I think before I'd got in the bath, no, it wouldn't have been before. It was after. I was like, I literally can't do this. I need an epidural. So the anaesthetist must have just got in time. In there in time before it was too late, because he whipped in, got the epidural in, and I felt so good. I just, like, I don't know, like it was like a sense of calm came over me. I regained control. I say this while I'm looking at a positive birth book about hypnobirthing, and that's what I'm trying to achieve with that. But I just regained control and I felt like I was together again and in control of what was going on. Like it was a really light epidural, but one that I just was like, this is cool. I can handle this. I can feel the contractions, but I'm not in the hurt locker. Like this is a good place to be. And so from that point, I don't even know how long I was in from that point until I had Charlotte, but Jan came, she came floating back in a floral dress and she said, we're going to have a baby now. And I was like, we are? This is amazing. And so she was prompting me to push. I guess that's one thing that the epidural voided me of feeling was that need to push. I did feel having Charlotte, but I didn't feel the need to push. Yeah. So I was just in the hospital bed, bearing down, pushing on Jen's command. Tom was down at my feet watching the baby be born, which he would have had never have thought he was doing. But yeah, she came out, I think I pushed maybe like 4 or 5 times. And she was born. Jan said to me, oh, do you want to, you know, like Kourtney Kardashian style, like touch your baby and lift it out. And I was like, ooh, that much for me. I don't know. I felt like that was my limit. I couldn't do that. I was like, I'm happy to like have a vaginal birth, but I don't need to be involved with it that much. So yeah, and she was born, and she was on my chest straight away. We had immediate skin to skin, and I was just like struck by this overwhelming sense of like I've done it. Like it was just I remember actually at one point the obstetrician came in and he was like, what did he say? There was some statistic. There was only like 1% or something ridiculous of women would progress to having a VBAC from the point that I was at. And I just said to him, you're looking at the 1%. Like I just remember being such a stubborn mole. I was like, I'm the 1%. Like I'm the 1%. Get out. And I just felt this overwhelming sense of satisfaction that I was the 1% that had had my VBAC with my 15-month gap, with my thyroid issue, and the pressure from the hospital to have an elective C-section and then, you know, the induction. And I just felt so good. But it was really interesting in saying that because I didn't have the same feeling that I had when I had Annie. Like, and it was really weird because, you know, she was obviously a C-section and this little baby whose gender we didn't know, Charlotte, she was born vaginally, and I thought that I'd have that massive hit. I thought I'd get that hit of, you know, the endorphins and just the bubble again, and it never came. Like it really never came. So although I had this sense of satisfaction at having had my baby in the way that I'd wanted to, it was kind of like the when we got home point with Annie, and now what? Like she was born and I was like, and now what? Like what happens now? Which was kind of a little bit not underwhelming, but it was overwhelming and underwhelming at the same time that I felt like I was like, when's that feeling coming? Like, and I was too busy thinking about that feeling then thinking about her, and then when actually she was born, this sounds awful. Like she was born and this sounds so awful saying this, but I was like, what's wrong with her? Like she was breathing and she was the right color and everything was fine, but her foot, it was like she was a ballerina. It was completely at a 90 degree angle. And I was just like, what's wrong with her foot? And so after, you know, we'd done the skin on skin, she had a feed, we had pediatricians come down and have a look at her, because they thought that she had a club foot, which hadn't been picked up in any of her scans, although she'd been like a little froggy. So we had, we had this little baby with this wee foot that was like a wee ballerina out. And I know that sounds, I feel really guilty for saying that, but I guess in all honesty, when I feel like I wanted to have my baby and I had this idea of having my baby, that it never crossed my mind that my baby wouldn't be perfect. And then when she was born, I just was like, oh my god, what is wrong with her? And that's just so awful. And there is absolutely nothing wrong with her. She's absolutely fine and she's an amazing little girl and she has nothing wrong with her. It was completely positional. Like her leg had been squashed for 9 months, and then it had just stayed like that, and as she's aged, it's moved and her muscles have relaxed and she has no problem. But it was just a really interesting sort of roller coaster of feelings of, you know, having achieved the VBAC that I wanted to, and then having this baby that I thought there was something wrong with, which there was nothing wrong with. Like a real mixed bag of emotions and understanding them and knowing how to feel and processing everything it's so bizarre.
I think there'll probably be a surprising amount of people out there who really relate to that story in some way, so thank you for sharing that part of it. I think it's really important to just remember that sometimes we don't feel that euphoric, you know, feeling that you spoke of in your first birth after giving birth, and that's okay too, right? Like, there's no difference in the way that you feel about your girls now. Yeah. It's just, yeah, you had a different feeling after your birth.
And I think it's the whole preconceived idea of what something should be like nothing, there's no like certain or right way of anything. And I think that's if listening to any of your podcasts is anything to go by, there is not one that is the same. And I think that just speaks volumes for how anyone's impression or interpretation of birth should be, is that there is no textbook to it. It is not always going to be, you know, plan A will happen, plan B will happen. Yeah. Like, it's sometimes it's a combination of all of those things, or I mean, sometimes they are textbook, but I think that's pretty rare. And just being aware, I guess, a bit more of something not being like the, you know, the Instagram birth or the, you know, the, yeah, you know what I mean? Like, it's, that's all very well, but it's not necessarily always real life, and that's not how it always goes.
Yeah, for sure. And so did you end up needing stitches, or did you have any tearing or anything like that from your birth?
Absolutely nothing. Like, I had Wonder Woman Jan at my side, and it's so funny. I had a friend who had said to me, she'd had Jan as her midwife as well, and she said, whatever you do, listen to Jan. And so I literally said to Tom at one point, I was like, turn the music off, I need to listen to Jan. And so the like serene, calm music got turned off, and I was just like focusing on her. And she was incredible. So I had no tearing. I had a little tiny graze. And Ural did the trick with that. Like, arm yourselves with Ural. If anyone ever says, what do I take to a hospital? I'm like, Ural and lollipops. That's all you need. But yeah, I just was focused on Jan, and I had such an amazing relationship with her. And I guess I was just lucky in some degrees as well. Like, I don't know, maybe I've got good skin. I don't know how that works. I was good. It was, I will say though, an absolute shocker having a vaginal birth. I was just like, oh my God, my bits are like roadkill. What is this? I just had no idea. Like, everyone, you know, you like freeze the pads and you wear them. I didn't do any of that because I didn't know what to expect. I was a C-section person, and my bits were all good. And then I just was like, this is incredible. Like, what's going on? And just this shock. And then I guess this like amazement at how incredible your body is to birth a baby and then heal and just kind of like, I mean, be normalish again. Like, I just was like, this is incredible. Look at the journey my body's been on. So, I definitely wasn't prepared for the roadkill, though. And it's probably a really bad thing to say. But get out there and do your VBAC, girls. But, yeah, be aware.
Yeah, cool. And how did you find things going home this time around? Obviously, you've got Annie at home as well, so it's not like the first time where there's just one baby. So how did you find going to being a mum of two? And, yeah, what was that journey like?
So we one thing that I did do after we got discharged from hospital was, and I will mention this other part, I had a catheter in, and I didn't expect what happened with my bladder control. So I remember we stopped in Gore because I needed to go to the bathroom, and I was wearing these grey track pants, really bad move, shouldn't have done that. And I went to walk to go to the a public bathroom on the main road, and I just didn't make it. Like, I just fully didn't make it. And I thought, what the hell? And I looked down at my pants, and it was like someone had like thrown a litre of water on my pants. And so I was like, okay. So I just like cruised back to the car, and Tom was like, are you okay? And I'm like, I don't even know what happened. Like, I didn't feel that happening. And that happened for maybe 2 days after I'd had Charlotte, just from having had that catheter in and and having had a vaginal birth. But, you know, I hadn't experienced that with Annie. So I thought that something wasn't right. But other than that, everything was fine and it came right, but it was a bit of a shock.
and I won't wear grey pants again, that's for sure. But yeah, no, we had 2 days again at Charlotte Jean, just with Charlotte, because we could have come home straight away. And I know a lot of people do that, but I thought, you know, this is the one and only time in Charlotte's life where she will just probably have the two of us for her every beck and call. So I was really aware of that. And, you know, I knew Annie would be fine. She was with her granny and her nanny Sharon, and everything was, you know, fine. And it was just so special to be able to bond with Charlotte, just the three of us. I will say, and I'm all over the place with this, I also forgot, when we were in the hospital, Charlotte just would not stop crying, just wouldn't stop. And I was trying to get her on my boob, feeding her as much as I could. And I was literally up from the moment that she was born. I did not sleep. She was crying and crying, to the point where one of the midwives was like, you know, I can take her away. And she took her away and to try and give me some rest. And then she ended up bringing her back like half an hour later. And she was just like, look, no, she's still hungry. She needs food, you know, can you feed her again? I was just spent at that point. I was just like, I can't, like, I have nothing here. Like, I just have colostrum and I don't know what to do. And so she said to me, oh, do you want us to feed her? And I was like, you know what? Like, I actually do. Like, can you just feed my baby? I was so tired. Tom actually had a tummy bug in the hospital as well. So he was completely out after having been sick most of the day. Worst place that someone could be sick and in a maternity ward, so bad. We should not have had him in there. But we did. So they ended up giving her some formula in hospital, and then we went to Charlotte Jean. I continued with it. She was just so hungry, and she was so much bigger than Annie. So she was like, Annie was like 3.2 kgs, and Charlotte was nearly 4. And she was just a really bushy little babe that needed food. The midwives described her as a bonny babe. And I was like, what does bonny mean? Like, what is that? Googled it. And I'm like, is that a compliment? But she just really needed food. So she had formula until my milk came in. And then it came in really well and really strong. And then we didn't need it anymore. And she was a really happy little babe. So, I just thought I'd mention that because it was a little bit of a – not a different journey comparatively to Annie, but it was different insofar as having a really hungry baby, whereas Annie was probably a bit more lucid from having been a C-section baby and just was like rolling with whatever. When we got home, like, it was the most delightful thing to see, because Annie was only 15 months old, so the whole concept of being pregnant to her was just, she obviously had no idea what was going on. You can't really explain much to a 15-month-old. And when we brought Charlotte home in the capsule and we just put her down and we said, you know, this is your baby. And she was just repeating baby, and she like would look at the baby and then run away and then come back and look at her. And I just, like, I had no doubt in my mind at any point that, we weren't doing the right thing by having another baby. But I just was like, this is so special. Having my girls so close together in age, like, you know, they're going to fight like mad, but hopefully they're going to be the best of friends as well. And yeah, just grow up together. It was just so special.
Yeah. Awesome. Very cool. And how was your recovery this time around in comparison to your C-section? Like, what was the differences, I guess? And do you have any advice for someone who might be going to have a VBAC soon?
Yeah, look, I mean, there are definite pros and cons either way. I was really lucky. I could pick up Annie. I could pick up Charlotte. Physically, everything was working great. I did have bladder control issues, though. That was, but I feel could be pretty standard with any sort of vaginal birth, but one that I kind of didn't expect. Like, I thought I had a strong pelvic floor, but I didn't. In hindsight, I didn't. People, do the pelvic floor exercises, and I'd do like 2 pumps, and I'm like, yeah, I'm done. Like, so bad. Yeah, I think, like, and I say this, and I should be doing the pelvic floor exercises now, and I'm still not. So that was the difficulty, I think, with having the vaginal birth, is that I had underestimated exactly what was required from my pelvic floor because I hadn't, I don't know, I just hadn't engaged or needed it at all with a C-section. So that was the only area that required work from me, and that was doing the clenching and the, you know, holding on, stopping my pee midstream and doing all of that kind of stuff. But beyond that, I was just so elated with having had a successful VBAC, and I felt really good. As I said, I could pick up Annie physically. I got back into exercise, you know, not too soon, but at the right time. And we were actually really lucky. I say lucky, and I know not everyone felt like this, but I think Charlotte was about 6 weeks old when we went into lockdown, and it was the best thing. I was just like, I'm at home with my partner and my babies, and we can all just be together. And it was really cool. Like, you know, so we did a bit of exercise, all of us, and it was just really, really special. So, yeah, I thought I'd add that in because I know not lockdown wasn't amazing for everyone, but I think having had a baby and listening to a lot of your podcasts, I think so much can be said about that time where you just are in your own bubble with your family and you don't have the visitors and you're not out there doing everything. Like, we just loved it. Like, we didn't have to take her anywhere. We just stayed at home, and she was amazing at home. I was under no pressure to go and see anyone or do anything or take Annie anywhere. Like, we just chilled at home. And my mum was like, well, that's what we did when we were, you know, your age with our babies. And I'm like, yeah. You also didn't have flat whites back then, but, you know, like, it's I guess it's completely different, but in retrospect, it was so lovely not to feel that pressure to have to go anywhere and do anything. And, yeah, we thrived off that.
Yeah. Awesome. Cool. And is there anything else that we haven't covered, Bridget, that you want to add about either of your stories or, you know, any part of your journey that you feel like we've missed?
No, I don't know. Like, I just think I think the most important thing is to feel empowered within yourself and to equip yourself with the knowledge that you feel comfortable with. You know, like, I've got a lot of friends that have had a C-section and then have gone on to have another subsequent C-section, and, you know, their babies were born healthy and mums were fine and healthy, and everyone at the end of the day is healthy. So I don't, you know, like, it doesn't matter how you birth your baby, as long as I think you are informed with how you do it, you accept that there are different ways that a birth can go, and at the end of the day, it's, you know, like, your body's amazing and you can only do what you can do and you can only fight for what you can fight for, and you know, your baby will come when it wants to come, or it will come when someone says it's coming. Like, it is, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, for sure. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Bridget, for coming on the podcast and sharing your two very different but very beautiful birth stories with us. I really appreciate you taking the time, and I think there'll be lots of people who get lots out of your episode. So thank you.
Oh, no, thank you. I hope they do. I really appreciate being able to share my story. So thank you, Jordan, for creating such an incredible platform for people to be able to share their stories.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's episode of Kiwi Birth Tales. I hope you have enjoyed it. I would love to see where you're listening, so make sure that you take a screenshot of this episode and share it on your stories and tag me at Kiwi Birth Tales. Really looking forward to bringing you another awesome episode next week, so keep an eye out.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.